Interface. Not the same questions, not the same answers.
Hello, I'm Brad Johnson, and welcome to Interface, a weekly examination of Christian perspectives on theology, philosophy, ethics, and culture with Adam Ayers, the pastor of Disciples Church in Costa Mesa, California, and he's also the founder of the Stoa Foundation. We have with us in the studio tonight Brian Griffith, and we thought that since we're in a very highly charged political atmosphere these days, what we thought we would do tonight is there are two topics of conversation that many people try to avoid, and we thought we would tackle them both at once, religion and politics.
Watch out, world.
Yeah, that's right. Namely, just to start out anyway, as a jumping off point, what should our involvement in politics be as Christians? Should we be involved in politics at all? And if so, what issues should we be concerned about? Any ideas on this, either of you?
I would ask, first off, what is politics? And then how would you even begin to define that? Because everything in our lives has political undertaking and undertow. So from that perspective, Adam, when you hear the word politics, what do you think of?
Brian, what you raise it there, I think, is really a critical issue, is that just by living in a society, one is political in some way. I think when we tend to think of politics, we tend to think of formal politics. But the reality is that if we have a conversation on a bus and I seek to in some ways impact your life or to change your opinion, I have somehow engaged in social action. And seeking to change anyone's thoughts or behaviors or ethics or moral stances, when we talk about religion and politics, they tend to both be volatile because both seek to bring about change in society by bringing about change in individuals and their opinions and their core beliefs. And so these two actually are wed inseparably. I think that's one of the hard things about the American system. The American system tends to be schizophrenic in that it says we will separate religion and politics, but we can't separate ourselves. And what we believe and feel religiously affects our politics, and how we conduct our politics affects our religious stances. And we found that to be true. In the living out of this thing. Like, I remember there was a poster on above my dad's desk many, many years ago. It was one of these think and grow rich kind of motivational posters. And this poster had one phrase on it that will stay with me all my life. It said, "Not to decide is to decide." If you decide, "Oh, I'm going to think about it later, rat," on some sort of a issue, you have decided a course of passivity. If you, on the other hand, decide that you're going to decide, you've decided on a course there. Life does not stop for our indecision. In the same way, if we decide to be without religious expression in our politics, then we have made a religious decision contrary to religion. Same way, if we decide to be religious in our society, we have made a political decision. So I think politics, speaking as a religionist, politics deals with the way that we govern and structure our society, and religion deals with the way that we structure and govern our worship, our highest loyalties. And these two will always compete and interact, our highest loyalties to nation or our highest loyalties to God, and they will have different sets of values attached to them in whole constellations of meaning.
Yeah, the one thing that drives me crazy on the political scene, we have a TV hooked up so we can watch Cinderella and 101 Dalmatians, that's about it. I could probably quote both those movies for you. But the thing I'll call it the liberal, because I don't have the proper slang, the liberal side of politics would say is, check your heart at the door, and check your faith at the door. So, and that came up, that thought, as you were speaking, that when you mix politics and religion, if you have a person is going to be somewhat political because we seek social order, and they're going to have some kind of faith. whether they want to believe it or not, or whether they want to even say they have faith. They have faith in something. And I just find it interesting that that you can't talk about that in public, is the sense that those two things are blended. I mean, you can't tell Bill Clinton to leave his heart or his mind or his faith at the door, or any other politician. So I think it's very important for people of faith to be involved in politics. It's just a struggle about how much and where our real home is, our real identity.
I think that brings up actually a number of things that you cite there bring up significant issues for Christians. One, the difference between a liberal politically and a conservative politically, and a liberal religiously and a conservative religiously. We have a tendency to equate conservatism politically with conservatism religiously, and those two aren't necessarily linked the same way liberality or freedom in religious faith with liberality in the political realm, and those two don't necessarily go together. So I think we're going to have to at least address what is a liberal politically and what is a liberal religiously, and are these two linked or are they separate? And the same thing with conservatism. Is the conservative right wing politically entitled to the support of the conservative church? And do they represent the same values? Because the conservative in the church is not necessarily a conservative in the political realm. I think the other thing you bring up there is, what kind of societal change will we look for? Will we look for formal change? Do we change the laws? Do the laws impact our society? Or do we change our society and the laws reflect our society? And this is a huge thing. Do we move society by changing its laws and its politicians? Or do we change the society and let the politicians follow behind? And that we have to ask, which is really a most effective way of changing our society? To change its institutions in a formal sense, or to change its constituents in an informal sense? And where should we best direct our energies, along with what values truly represent a Christian stance when it comes to societal change? I think that is the issue we need to assess. What values did Christ stand for, and therefore what values must we and should we as Christians represent and seek to bring about in our society?
Are you saying that, let's say, in the national media or in some of the more conservative think tanks or groups, that they haven't done a good job defining what those values really are?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. For example, typical conservative political stance, a strong law and order stance, right? Now, although on the one hand you hear this is a Christian family value stance because this is anti-crime, all right? This is anti-non-religious behavior. This is anti-sin. However, at the same time, we have to ask ourselves, now let's see. The person of Christ, was he one who tended to be strong on law and order, or was he one who tended to be strong on the abrogation of law and order in favor of grace? For example, we have the story of the woman caught in adultery. What is the question that they pose to Christ? They drag this woman out. They say, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act, non-Christian sexual behavior. Think how many laws the Christian coalitions tend to support about sexual behavior, okay? This woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now, the law says we should stone her. What do you say? Does Christ support a law and order stance, or does Christ support a non-law and order stance?
Yeah, but you can't run a country on grace.
Why not?
Well, grace is always taken advantage of, in my opinion.
That's true. Does that mean you can't run a country on it?
Is there any kind of a statute or any kind of thing that you – any country you've ever seen that's been run on grace? Besides a commune of folks that live up in the corner of somewhere and they share everything, but they share a common value. They share a common theology.
Okay. By that, I would say, well then, all that establishes is that a community never really has been – a government never really has been established around Christian principles. We would tend to say our country was founded on Christian principles, but would we not say the primary Christian principles are love and grace? So does that mean that love and grace won't work as the foundation for a community, or does it mean that we really have never been a Christian nation and we have never really been a society which operates truly according to Christian principles? Yeah, I think that's some of the difficulty that we have to wrestle with as Christians. What is our very foundational social and ethical and moral stance?
I wonder, though, if a country can be Christian in a sense that in a country, so to speak, of a country, there's a heart to it, so to speak. So I guess you could say that. But people have hearts, and people are why Christ came. So wouldn't it be more the majority of the people are Christian, therefore, because the majority are Christian, because we're set up in a system where the majority rule, therefore, shouldn't the Christian principles rule?
I think then we have to ask, again, that takes us back to the question, what are Christian principles? If Christian principles are love and grace and forgiveness and mercy, then if we are the Christian majority, then we need to seek to bring society and its institutions to a place that reflect love and grace and compassion and mercy, rather than necessarily what is seen as conservatism, law, order, structure. See? Are those truly Christian agenda? Are those not Christian agenda? I think as well, this brings up the issue, are we the Christian minority or are we the Christian majority? I hear much talk saying we need, oh, those dirty liberals have grabbed the reins of power in our country and have taken over the country, and now the Christians are a losing minority. Okay, this is one of the distress banners raised. We've lost control of the country. We need to turn the country back to the place where it was when it was a God-fearing nation. What that says is this nation is not a God-fearing nation. We are not a majority. This is not a majority stance. It says we are a minority, those who wish to be God-fearing. But we seek to gain control of the reins of power and influence and law in order to turn the society to a place where we become the majority and, quote unquote, bring it back to being a Christian nation. But what we're really saying is we are a minority trying to seize the halls of power and, through the use of the halls of power, convert the nation to where we are now a majority, which is a kind of a violation of what we're supposedly saying. See what I mean? And there was this Auld Lang Syne that says somehow, somewhere back in the old days, we really were the majority. But, you know, we don't find a place where America, for one, ever existed on the principles of love and compassion and mercy. See? These would be the... I mean, when they ask Christ, what is it that is most important to do? Love God with all your heart, love your neighbor as yourself. Have we done that? Or have we built it around greed, the consolidation of wealth, see, power around the individual?
In a situation like that, do you think that that the people are putting the government in the place that God should be in their life?
Yes, Social Security would lend itself that, and welfare would lend itself to people seeing government as a provisionary God. I mean, ask yourself this. In your own life, where does the government provide? I mean, I know I've heard someone in this room say before they like our roads. they treat their car well. They like running water. We like the security that our government can give us, and obviously that it protects our borders is a tremendous to go to sleep at night and have two beautiful children and another one on the way. It's amazing to think about the protection that a government can give you. And I'll stand up and say, I think that even is is something that's wonderful. I mean, I spent some time in Russia right after the Cold War, so to speak, right after about 7 years ago. And that's a gloomy place. I was in the Ukraine. We went to Poltava and Kharkov and Kiev and with some wonderful men and women. And we went over on actually a mission trip and played football. And after about 2 weeks, we taught these guys how to play and they killed us. But we actually won on the scoreboard. But to be there and to actually see what their government had done to those people, to not see a smile, makes me think, hey, government plays a very important role. The question is, how much of my heart does the government get? How much of my time, how much of my money, how much of my mind am I willing to give? My grandfather thought all. He fought in the wars, in World War II, and I certainly would respect anyone who would go to battle for our country, and I think that's incredible. I mean, to give your life for your country, and if it ever called, I mean, I hope that I'd be brave enough, but when you think about that, I mean, how much should a Christian give for their country? I mean, how much would you be willing to give? And then as you start thinking about that in relationship to politics in general, I've only voted one time that I can really remember. The other times I just too busy, too much going on. And I bet if we went around the room or if you went around any room with my type of age people, you'd be surprised how many times they voted.
Yes. One wonders if all the persons who give their opinions on politics voted, what the changes would be. But one of the things you bring up there, Brian, is the idea of how much would one give up for one's nation. And I think this is a very, again, another important part for Christians to consider. Where do our highest loyalties lie? Religion is the expression of one's primary or highest loyalties and affinities, right? It's one's worship relationship. Some of the things I think that we need to think about are, first off, did Christ and the apostles engage in formal institutional change? Did they even raise their voices against the formal institutions of their day? When you think, where did they live? They lived not only in an occupied nation. See, they lived in a nation occupied by Rome. Okay? Rome was not, you know, the most godly of states. It was pagan. It was oppressive. It had all of those things which we would assume to be violations of human rights, slavery, unequal citizenship, see, military oppression. And yet, do we hear Jesus raising his voice against that? Do we hear the apostles raising their voices against that? Or do we hear Paul, of all people, Paul saying, you know, pray for the king, respect the government. That is the sword of the Lord appointed by the Lord. And he's talking, who's king in his time? He's talking like Nero, okay? And he's saying, you know, support Nero. He's the sword of the Lord. I mean, that's the same sword that cut off Paul's head.
Yeah, support Nero and go to a Christian barbecue.
Yeah, you know. Exactly.
Now, in the situation that they found themselves in, though they were in an occupied situation, we're in a country where we have an opportunity to have a say in who our elected officials are, where they weren't necessarily. So does that put us in a different game?
Yes, I think it does. That we're in a situation politically where we are given voice. I think because of that, we have to say, how will we use this voice? Will we use this voice to represent secondary or tertiary Christian concerns or primary Christian concerns? For example, okay, this is going to be a hot one. A few years ago in California, we faced the Prop 187 issue, right? Should we or should we not remove social services for illegal aliens? Okay. And this is one of the few times I've stated my political opinions publicly. I was appalled that Christians would actually vote for this thing. Not only because in the Old Testament, it is very, very clear how Israel is to treat the visiting stranger in their midst, the alien in their midst. Treat them well because you were also once aliens in Egypt. See, there's over and over again, treat the alien well, treat them with more respect, practice hospitality, give them everything that they need. They may even be angels unawares. But the question that came to my mind is, since when has the church been for conserving resources over against being compassionate? And it's like, well, these people are illegal aliens. They are human beings. Are we not to be compassionate? Whoso seeth his brother have need and shut up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? So the critical question there was, which is better? To try to do that which is financially more secure for our nation, or to do that which represents the nature of Christ with our funds and resources? Are we here to make our nation straight, safe, and strong, or are we here to divest our nation on behalf of Christ with our influence? See, which one are we to do? It says that Christ came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. Is the Christian paradigm to make ourselves safe at the expense of others, or to make ourselves vulnerable on behalf of others?
Well, it's easier to say, you know, vote yes on Prop 187 and conserve my money or what have you. I mean, I worked in the hospitals for a while, and I used to see folks come right over the border, roll in, and gosh, you need a total hip surgery. Well, that'll cost $50,000. And mm-hmm. And by the way, you know, the vendor will have to bite that and eat that of the product, and the physician won't get paid for it, and the hospital won't get paid, and that'll be a write-off. That was just the way it was done. But obviously, you know, the Christian thing, when Well, I don't want to say obviously, because anything obvious is never obvious.
It's never quite so obvious.
Yeah. But I mean, we used to be a country that sent missionaries, and now we're a country that has missionaries sent in. And our perspective is to conserve. And I think people are more comfortable in that. And the fallback was the law says if you're illegal, you're illegal.
Mm-hmm. So the question then for a Christian is, well, do we say, well, the law says you're illegal, or do we change the law to make them legal and say, well, then, obviously, that is an immoral law which prevents certain people from having care. Therefore, let's change the law and make these people legal. See, that would also be an expression of Christian influence on our society and Christian influence on political clout for Christian values. But because that is seen as politically liberal, we say, oh, no, 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 no. We have to be political conservatives rather than political liberals if we are to be religious conservatives. And I, as a religious conservative, say, no, no. If you are religiously conservative enough, you will say the mandates of Christ come before pragmatism. The mandates of Christ say, I need to be compassionate before I am practical, before I believe in capitalism, before I believe in America. I must first follow the kingdom of God and use all my clout to move that way. For example, with the Clinton thing. You know, since when has Christianity desired to see the most amount of damage brought upon somebody for their sins rather than the least amount of damage? And we have to ask ourselves that first. Are we people of mercy? Are we people of forgiveness? Or are we people who are willing to do somebody under on their mistakes for political advantage and political expedience, just like the next guy?
Something happened to Clinton?
The whole Clinton controversy, the whole chapter in American history.
I gotta say, you know, I mean, the guy's, he's not doing anything to help himself. but I think you're right. I mean, there's been an
But neither did King David.
Amazing amount of swarm on that issue.
Yeah, there's and this is to stir up a very hotbed of things. But I think what we have to say is the presence of this issue does cause us to have to re-examine how we go about facing our assessment of political crises. Do we assess them according to Christian values, or do we assess them according to political values?
Yeah. Well, the question is, are you willing to go bankrupt for your faith as a country?
Yes. That's exactly it. Are we willing to value our faith before our money? Are we willing to value compassion before the quote-unquote stability of our society? Will we allow God to be the one who superintends and is the custodian of our society rather than saying it is up to us to keep our society safe by our practicality? Or will we say we will be godly, and if our society falls apart around us, then that's what happens. But we will be people of faith, people of mercy and compassion. Again, I think about David. David was king. David did all kinds of bizarre things. Adultery, sexual immorality there, murder, misuse of his authority as the commander of the army in order to murder one of his bodyguards. Go figure. And God rebuked him. God did. And then he let him be king. Continued on. Let him continue being king and made his son from that marriage that we would say, if the king married, according to Christ, you know, you marry somebody in that kind of situation, you're committing adultery the whole time. Took the son from that union, Solomon, and made him the next king, which is amazing. But we have to say, what will we honor? Will we honor God and say, well, take care of us, Lord. If you don't take care of us, nobody will. But if we live by you, we have faith that somehow this will be honoring enough that either you will watch over us or you will not. You will be our shepherd or you will not. And we commit ourselves and our conduct to you. But we will go broke and defenseless, trying to be what you have called us to be. Christ got himself strung up. He wasn't very practical. He was very godly.
Hmm. So God put Clinton in office?
Read Romans 13.
Mm-hmm.
Adam and Brian, you've certainly provided some serious fuel for future conversations for us in this room and those
and for drive-by shootings.
I just hope I'm still married.
Thank you both very much for being here today.
Thank you, Bradley.
We'd like to thank Chris Hollowaddy, our engineer, for all his hard work. Thanks to Media City Sound for helping to make Interface possible. And thanks to you for listening.